This is VOA News. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Florida's Secretary of State has ordered a manual recount in the state's hotly contested U.S. Senate race. Department of State spokeswoman Sarah Revell said in a news release Thursday evening that unofficial returns from a machine recount had triggered a second recount in the Senate race and the state agriculture commissioner's race. Susan Booker is Palm Beach County's supervisor of elections.
What happens is that they separate ballots by a verified vote for one candidate, verified vote for another. Another stack is an under, another stack is an over, and then the questionable ones go to the canvassing board.
Democratic incumbent Bill Nelson trailed his Republican challenger, Florida Governor Rick Scott, by just 1.15% of more than 8 million ballots cast following an electronic recount. The total is due by noon on Sunday. The United States is adding sanctions against several Saudi officials it says were involved in the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. As AP Washington correspondent Sagar Meghani reports, the move comes after a Saudi prosecutor sought the death penalty for five people involved in the case.
The 17 Saudis already face travel bans, and the Treasury Department's now freezing any assets they may have in the U.S. and banning Americans from doing business with them. Among those facing sanctions are one of the Saudi crown prince's chief aides. Saudi Arabia's top prosecutor says he will seek the death penalty for five men charged in the killing. But with the kingdom under intense global scrutiny, the announcement appeared aimed at distancing the alleged killers from Saudi leadership, including the crown prince, whom Khashoggi had criticized. Saudi Arabia's top diplomat says the crown prince had absolutely nothing to do with the killing. Sagar Meghani at the White House.
For more on these stories, log on to our website, voanews.com. This is VOA News. Britain's Prime Minister Theresa May says that she will continue her plans to exit from the European Union, but those plans took a hit Thursday when her Brexit Secretary Dominic Raab resigned. AP's Charles de Ledesma has the details.
May is battling to save her Brexit deal and her job as ministers quit her government and a growing list of lawmakers demand her ouster over the divorce agreement struck between Britain and the EU. The hard-won deal has, in particular, infuriated pro-Brexit members of her divided party. They say it calls for close trade ties between Britain and the bloc, and that would leave Britain bound to EU rules it has no say in making. Charles de Ledesma, London.
The death toll from devastating wildfires in California has risen to 59 as authorities search for dozens of people who remain missing in the aftermath of the blazes. The weather gave firefighters a break on Thursday. Authorities said cooler temperatures helped crews gain ground as they fought the deadly campfire, which is now 40% contained. Late Thursday, the White House announced that President Donald Trump would travel to California to meet with people displaced by the fires. Trump initially criticized the state for what he called poor forest management and threatened to withhold federal money. He has since declared the fire-ravaged portions of California a disaster area, opening the way for federal assistance. The man accused of sending pre-election package bombs to several prominent Democrats, including two former presidents, has been arraigned in federal court in New York. AP's Warren Levinson reports.
Cesar Sayoc pleaded not guilty through his attorney to charges of sending pipe bombs in the mail. The 56-year-old Florida man was arrested last month after improvised explosive devices showed up at the homes and offices of Trump critics, including the Clintons, the Obamas, Congresswoman Maxine Waters, and CNN. Sayoc had been living in a van plastered with Trump stickers. Some of the packages were mailed to New York addresses. None went off. Judge Jed Rakoff set a trial date of July 15th. The charges carry a potential sentence of life in prison. Warren Levinson, New York.
It's official. 2018 is toxic. Oxford dictionaries have chosen toxic as the international word of the year. Traditionally defined as poisonous, Oxford said people are also using it to describe relationships, workplaces, politics, and habits. Oxford lexicographers said it's the sheer scope of its applications that has made it the standout choice. Toxic beat out gaslighting and orbiting, which describes withdrawing personal contact from someone, but continuing to follow them on social media. For more on these stories, log on to our website, voanews.com. You can follow us on the VOA mobile app. I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, November 16th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A new report by the Doctors Association of Zimbabwe accuses the army of killing six post-election protesters last August.
What is good about it is that the whole world now knows what we have been crying for as the MDC for the past 19 years, that these guys are violating our rights with impunity.
Tabitha Kumalo is chairperson of the Zimbabwe opposition MDC, led by Nelson Chamisa. But the government says the report is not credible because the Doctors Association is sponsored by the opposition. Refugees in Uganda say hostile host communities is one of their major challenges. And is a new people movement in Uganda gaining momentum?
You know that in Uganda we have got a leadership that has been around for over 33 years. So our movement is about ushering in a new era in Uganda that will make that country better.
Michael Mabiki is a former Ugandan member of parliament, and the second annual Access Conference to help African musicians is being held this weekend in Dakar, Senegal. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The Zimbabwe Association of Doctors for Human Rights has accused the country's army of gunning down six people in August this year during an opposition protest against delays in announcing the July 30th presidential election results. The doctors, who attended to the wounded and documented cases of the post-election violence, say the army perpetrated violence against innocent civilians. The organization has recommended that the perpetrators of the alleged killings be arrested and prosecuted. Tabitha Kumalo, chairperson of the Opposition Movement for Democratic Change, MDC Wing, led by Nelson Chamisa, says the report vindicates what the MDC has been saying all along.
As MDC party led by Advocate Nelson Chamisa, we have been exonerated. We raised the issue of human rights violations by ZANU-PF government, women being raped, kidnapped, beaten, killed, maimed, and we're told that we are hallucinating. But with the evidence that we managed to get from the doctors and the injured, we were able to produce that evidence which gave birth to Zedera, which they are claiming as sanctions. Zedera was basically banning the people who violated the rights of Zimbabweans when they were exercising their right to vote for the leaders of their choice.
And in this case, you know, the Doctors for Human Rights are recommending that those people who committed these atrocities should be arrested. Do you think that's possible?
In the ZANU-PF government, forget about the perpetrators of any violation. As long as they are aligned to ZANU-PF, they'll never be arrested. Instead, the victims and the survivors are the ones that are going to be victimized, and they will be arrested and accused of having maimed themselves, raped themselves, burnt their own houses, destroyed their cattle. So in this country, as long as ZANU-PF is in power, they will do as they please, and no one is going to be brought to justice. But what is good about it is that the whole world now knows what we have been crying for as the MDC for the past 19 years, that these guys are violating our rights with impunity, and no one has been brought to justice.
We have been talking to some ZANU-PF activists who are saying that this document was actually compiled by the Zimbabwe Doctors for Human Rights in conjunction with your party.
These are the only doctors who are able to help victims of political violence for very one simple reason. Victims of political violence can never get any treatment in any government hospital, because when you walk into a government hospital and you are maimed, you need to go and report to the police first before you are treated. And what is that victim expected to say when you are being asked by the same system that has maimed you?
Tabitha Kumalo is the chairperson of Zimbabwe's opposition MDC, led by Nelson Chamisa. She spoke from Harare with Gabe Dube of US Zimbabwe Service. But Zimbabwe's ruling ZANU-PF party says the report by the Zimbabwe Association of Doctors for Human Rights is not credible because it was sponsored by the opposition MDC, led by Nelson Chamisa. The Association of Doctors for Human Rights has dismissed the government's claims as baseless. But Believe Gawley, a ZANU-PF Central Committee member, says the report was not compiled in a transparent way, and as a result, it does not reflect the view of state security agents, who say they had nothing nothing to do with the alleged August 1st killing of protesters.
It becomes very difficult, really, for me to say maybe the report is really coming from the people, and this is what they've been gathering from the people. But yes, of course, there are some of those things, I think, that came out when the people testified in various places where the commission conducted its findings. But at the same time, they should have come out in the open so that people know exactly what they are gathering, people's views, and so that maybe they are even monitored by some other government agents to make sure really that these are the things that are coming from the people.
So in a way, you are saying these privately conducted interviews that they did, plus the assessment that they made on people that were shot, was supposed to be something public?
I am saying due to the political situation that is prevailing at the moment, they should have conducted public hearings. Like I'm saying right now, I really never know whether these people really gathered views from the people, or maybe they're just being used by some other groups.
So if you're saying they're being used by some other groups, tell us a bit about what you think those groups could be.
I have a feeling that the opposition MDC is really pushing that agenda, because they've come out openly to say they don't accept whatever the results, but all what they know is that the people were killed by the army. ZANU-PF has also a different view altogether.
The group has also recommended that some ZANU-PF activists need to be arrested and prosecuted for allegedly beating up and raping, you know, women before and after the general elections. So what's your take on that?
I think we need also to rely on the outcome of the views that were gathered by the commission. But at the same time, after the report, I think the government must act, the president must act, and the perpetrators must be brought to book. I support that 100%, that those people who were involved need to face the music.
Believe Gole is a member of Zimbabwe's ruling ZANU-PF Central Committee. He spoke from Bulawayo with Gabe Dube of VOA Zimbabwe Service. A former Ugandan member of parliament says a new people power movement is gaining momentum to bring about political change in Uganda. Michael Mambiki says the movement aims to wrest power from 73-year-old President Yoweri Museveni, in power now for 32 years. Mr. Museveni has said he wants to retire, but that the Ugandan people keep re-electing him after every 5 years when his term expires. A Ugandan constitutional court earlier this year upheld a constitutional amendment to remove presidential age limit, making it possible for Mr. Museveni to extend his rule. Former MP Mambike says he's currently visiting the United States to link up with the Ugandan diaspora individuals and organizations to strengthen the people power movement.
You know that in Uganda, we have got a leadership that has been around for over 33 years. This is a regime that shot its way into power. They promised many things. They promised the restoration of democracy. They promised the restoration of human rights. They promised a better Uganda. But 33 years down the road, we see more or less that we are back to where we began. So our movement is about ushering in a new era in Uganda that will make that country better.
I think either it was you or the Honorable Bobby Wine who said that Uganda's liberation was near, but it seems lately that President Museveni has been trying to stifle the movement.
That's correct. President Museveni took Ugandans to a hill. He showed us the promised land, and he later denied it to us. And we are saying that there is no turning back. We cannot return back to the bad old past. We need to move forward. President Museveni himself said, Uganda's problem is not economics. Uganda's problem is nothing but the politics. That Africa's problem is because of leaders who overstay in power. He, too, himself has now changed that. He has changed the constitution, you know, twice. He has removed the constitution term limits. He has removed the constitutional age limit. And as such, that is perceived as a way of paving life presidency, a situation that is akin to Idi Amin, because it is only Idi Amin in Uganda who has ever thought about becoming a life president. So that's a situation that modern times cannot be acceptable. And we are very worried about the Ugandan development, because there is no country in the world that has had a leader for 35 years and that country remains stable.
But the president has said that he wants to retire, but it is the people of Uganda that are appealing to him that he should continue on.
That is a flimsy excuse. I think leadership is about guidance. You cannot be led by the people that you lead. A leader makes choices. That's why you're called a leader. A leader is about guiding and showing people the way. The people cannot show the leader the way. He went to the bush himself. I don't think that people ask him to go to the bush, but he led the people to the bush. So I think it is time that he leads Ugandans in a better position than he found them.
You are here to talk about the movement. So what sort of reception are you getting from Ugandans here?
Yes, the People Power Movement, first of all, is a very popular movement back at home. It is actually running in place of the National Resistance Movement. It is doing exactly what the National Resistance Movement intended to do, because the National Resistance Movement wanted to demystify the presidency. Wanted to give power back to the people. Along the way, after capturing power, they instead monopolized it. We have had now power in the control of one man, one family, one clique, one tribe, one religion. Power by the gun, not by the people. And refusing to share that power, to give out that power. Now, the People Power Movement is about getting that power away from one man, away from one family, away from the gunmen, back to the people.
Andrew Mambike, thank you very much for joining us on Daybreak Africa. We're so happy to have you here.
Thank you so much.
Michael Mambike is a former member of Uganda's parliament. He was speaking with me in our Washington studio. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, November 16th, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17 minutes past the hour. Refugees in Uganda say hostile host communities is one of their major challenges they are facing, but the Ugandan government says development projects could return normalcy in the relations between the refugees and host communities. In another development, the Ugandan government said Thursday it is considering canceling the refugee status of the more than 14,000 Rwandans still living in Uganda and issuing them temporary permits. Minister for Relief, Disaster Preparedness and Refugees, Hilary Onek, said the process of convincing the refugees to return home has not been easy, as many are not willing to return to Rwanda. Moses Javier Rimana reports from Unsingiro in western Uganda.
Uganda is ranked third in the world as the refugee hosting nation, with 67% of the refugees coming from South Sudan. According to the latest figures, Uganda hosts 1.1 million refugees from 9 different nationalities, of which 44,000 are Burundians. However, recently there have been hostility by the host communities, who say that the refugees were being treated better than the locals. Land, shelter and access to education are said to be fueling the hostility of the host communities towards the refugees. Musa Echweru is Uganda's State Minister for Relief and Disaster Preparedness.
We have decided what we call humanitarian development nexus. We are no longer just doing humanitarian work. We must cause development in the host communities so that the host communities don't feel the burden of hosting these people. And the host communities start feeling, oh, maybe having them is a benefit after all. But the idea is not that we are benefiting from refugees. The idea is we are making the coast communities cushion the coming of these people.
Nachi Valley Camp is one of the settlements that experienced hostile local communities in hosting refugees. The settlement hosts more than 100,000 refugees from 9 different countries. Mutawe Mark is a local administrator in Isingiro district.
The situation was bad because me, I'm a share person, C3, because there were no boundary. So the settlement has no boundary. So the host community was bad.
According to the local authorities, there have been cases of confrontation between the host communities and the refugees, mainly caused by the competition for land, lacked shelter, clean water and access to education. The government is now developing a mechanism for local communities to benefit from at least 30% of the funds meant for refugees. Joel Butru is the UNHCR representative in Uganda.
The government complained that we don't deliver enough for host communities. I fully agree, and I've been saying that since I've arrived, that we need to give more to host communities, because if we don't give more to the host communities, this could jeopardize the very generous asylum policy of the government. Let's not take the generosity of Uganda for granted.
The Ugandan government says it expects to get a grant of $60 million and a borrow from the World Bank a sum of $82 million in efforts to build schools and infrastructure for the host communities as part of the efforts to restore better relations between the refugees and the host communities in the country. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Isingiro, Western Uganda.
When the sun sets on the Kakuma refugee camp in Kenya, many activities come to an end because of electricity outages. But that is beginning to change as residents invest in solar panels. The panels have already transformed care at a health clinic in a sprawling camp, which houses 140,000 refugees from across East Africa. Mohamed Yusuf reports.
1 year ago, this clinic in the Kakuma refugee camp was packed with patients and most had to wait hours to see a doctor or nurse. That's because there wasn't a constant power supply. Healthcare providers say the unreliable power supply causes vaccines to spoil and staff to stop working when they are using essential medical and diagnostic devices. Now, with solar power panels installed, there are fewer patients waiting. The clinic can provide services more hours per day and treat the sick in a few minutes.
This solar installation has improved the services for us, especially in the lab. One, we can be able to store reagents here for lab equipment to be used during the time of examination. And we are also able to keep sustain a cold chain for immunization for children under 5.
Before solar power, the outlook for students who wanted to get an education looked bleak. However, the introduction of solar power energy in Kakuma is providing opportunities to students who want to further their studies.
In the camp, there is after primary, secondary school, there is no chance maybe to go to do higher education. But if there is internet here, and then it helps us even open door for us to do further education and have chance at least to have more skills and do so many things.
According to aid agencies, authorities have long neglected refugee camps and rural areas, but a few companies like Baybox are venturing in to provide alternative energy sources.
Private sector is making them more and more affordable, and it's actually, they can provide better services than governments can provide. Instead of somebody living in a refugee camp or settlement waiting for the government come and, you know, solve their problem, you can get two or three or four companies coming in offering you different solutions that you can pay for.
More than 80% of Kakuma's population still doesn't have access to clean, reliable energy, officials say. But that number is starting to shrink as solar panels gain in popularity. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Kakuma, Kenya.
This weekend, the Music in Africa Foundation will hold its second annual Access conference to help African musicians connect with each other and with other professionals. One of the goals this year, as the foundation celebrates its fifth anniversary, is to improve the mobility for musicians looking to travel within Africa but facing visa hurdles. A chairperson of Music in Africa, Aisha Demi, talks to Ricky Stryak about the ways they are helping musicians earn a living.
At the beginning, we had just the portal, which is musicinafrica.net, which is a portal who is dedicated to the music industry in Africa, to have all information you need about music in Africa, like profile of artists, like education section, like and then the project went bigger, and now we have the conference, which is the Music in Africa Conference for Collaboration, Exchange and Showcases, which is happening each year in a different country in Africa.
In the last 5 years, what have you learned about how to help local artists, you know, be able to make a living? I know it's very difficult for all artists now because of pirating and all of these things. So, you know, what have you guys learned that can help these artists make a living?
Absolutely. It's like showing them those who did success in this way, the example, the success stories that are coming and talking to them. What we have learned is that, which is important, is to do, they're doing a lot of live music. It's not just enough to have an album. So they need to have a lot of concert. They need to do live music and to do it good and find the concert and find the collaboration. You know, you have a lot of artists who are in countries where there is war or there is conflicts. And it's about mobility. Sometimes they even cannot go outside the country. So this project helps them to produce an album and to have outside and having a lot of concert, having showcases all around Africa and even some.
That was Aisha Demi, chairperson of Music in Africa. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Dakar, Senegal. Twenty-five minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you, James. We begin the sport with a look at this weekend's Confederation of Africa Football AFCON 2019 qualifying fixtures, where a total of 24 matches will be played at various venues across the continent. 15 countries could secure their places at the 2019 tournament this weekend. Mauritania, who have never qualified for the African Cup of Nations, will look to make history when they host Botswana in a Group I qualifier. The team will be assured of a top two finish in Group I and qualification if they defeat Botswana. Another big game fixture is the one involving Bafana Bafana of South Africa and the Super Eagles of Nigeria. South Africa need a win and Nigeria a draw from their Group E clash on Saturday at the FNB Stadium in Johannesburg to be certain of qualification after both teams missed the 2017 tournament. Bafana Bafana coach is Stuart Baxter.
I just want us to have this, the same advantage that Nigeria had when we went to Ujo. You know, that was an intimidating atmosphere. I would love the South African public to come and help us get past this one.
Captain of the Nigerian Super Eagles, Ahmed Musa, and striker Kelechi Iheanacho both expect victory over South Africa.
Yeah, we are going out there. We are not going to disrespect South Africa because they talk a lot. So we are going there with full respect. As you can see, everybody is just ready. And the outcome of the game is determined after 90 minutes. So we are going out there to win, not to lose.
For me especially, I'm ready, but I think the team as well, we are ready. And we are working really hard to make sure that we get our revenge against South Africa.
Elsewhere, away victories for Algeria and Benin Republic over Togo and the Gambia respectively will secure qualification from Group D, while Zimbabwe need a draw in Liberia to advance from the group. Moses Gazawu reports from Monrovia that for the first time, Liberia's Lone Star coach Thomas Kujo has included English side Newcastle United under 23 midfielder Mohamed Sangare in the squad that is expected to play Zimbabwe.
When Coach Kujo took charge of the team in July, Sangare became one of his prime targets to strengthen his squad for the remaining matches in the 2019 AFCON qualifiers. The 20-year-old Newcastle under 23 midfielder could not make it for the last three fixtures due to work permit issues.
Missing the call up was obviously a little bit of, you know what it was, like the lot of misunderstanding, but I was frustrated, most of it. I was frustrated, but now, so I will do what I can to help the team and hopefully we can get the win.
With Sangare in the squad, the Lone Star coach told me it was an important addition to his squad.
His foundation coming through a program like the Newcastle under 23, and I think he's going to fit in our system.
Moses Gazio, VOA Sports, Monrovia.
And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. We look forward to your report again on Monday morning. And that is it for this Friday, November 16th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Botti in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very, very good weekend.
It's the weekend, and whatever you're doing, you could use a little extra love. Music love, that is. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa, and I've got the perfect weekend show for you.
I just called to say I love you.
First, over 30 minutes of the continent's best pan-African music, commercial free. Second, Song of the Week, Janjo by Daju. And then two exclusive interviews with artist Soul Prayer from Harare, Zimbabwe, and Free Boy from Kano, Nigeria.
Anywhere I go, I am the number one.
It's your boy, Free Boy Sani, DJ Blando on the beat, Duma Records.
So, lots of music love coming your way. Don't miss it. Music Time in Africa, this Sunday, 5 minutes past the hours of 15 and 2000 UTC.